saben ordeñar y saben hacer una pastura, todo. O sea, hay un montón de cosas que se aprendió. Lo que nos sirvió es que aprender a vivir en una comunidad.
You're listening to Back in the USSR.
Eso no cambió mucho.
So we say, we always say to Black Panther Party that they can do anything they want to us. We might not be back. I might be in jail. I might be anywhere. But when I leave, you can remember I said with the last words on my lips that I am a revolutionary. And you're going to have to keep on saying that. You're going to have to say that I am a proletarian. I am the people. I'm not the pig. You've got to make a distinction. And the people are going to have to attack the pig. The people are going to have to stand up against the pig.
Welcome home, comrades. Welcome home. Woo. Welcome home, Marshall Eddie Conway. Welcome home, Tunjata Akoli. Welcome home. Take your sacrifice. Welcome home, Sekou Obeda. Take your sacrifice. Cause you don't know if it's an afterlife. If it's an afterlife. Take your sacrifice.
I live for today, no time to play, and got no time for no games. Remembering the song when I'm dead and I'm gone, buried be dead in the flames. Make them remember your name, staking your claim in this lifetime. Nothing to lose, everything to gain, and it's rightfully mine. Matulu Shakur opened the door and took me up under his wing. I sat at the table, drank from the ladle, now I got something to bring. Salute to the youth that walk with the truth, I'm ready to give their stripes. You're never too young, remember their hungers, now they're giving the strikes. Bobby Hutton, yeah, Bobby Hutton, I say it again and again. First to join, first to die, independent for self-defense. 15 years old, the brother was cold, he had the heart of 1,000 men. Long live his name. I think about him when I train, so now we gon' win. Fred said, don't never be scared, cause you too young to die. Cause you feel you already did, now just paralyzed. Don't tell me your destiny, take the future into your hands. If anyone can do it, then you can. Take your sacrifice. Take your sacrifice. Cause you don't know if it's an afterlife. If it's an afterlife. Take your sacrifice. Take your sacrifice, cause you don't know if it's an afterlife. If it's an afterlife.
It's so serious, yeah, it's so serious. Emergency is cardiac arrest. If you thuggin', then you better wear a vest. This is the reality, it's not a test.
Twyman Myers set him on fire, he was down with the BLA. He was 16 when he picked his team and sacrifice was made. When I say sacrifice, I don't mean to do nothing stupid. Participation is the best education, say Huey Newton. Scared money don't make no money, that's what they say in them streets. And victory is so sweet versus the agony of defeat. I'd rather down my knees and live as a coward up in these streets. And dying, let's stop dying, if you with it then let's get free. The youth brigade ever so brave, never get led to the slaughter. The next to change the future, we the best of the sons and daughters. My back to the wind, my feet to the ground, I'm putting it down for my crown. But not in the colony, focus with my philosophy, that's what I'm about. I learned from the Palestinians and the Mexican EZLN. The government that's down with imperialism can't be your friend. They bad boy politicians saying show me the Benjamins. But I'm throwing up RBG until the end.
Take your sacrifice. Take your sacrifice. Cause you don't know if it's an afterlife. If it's an afterlife. Take your sacrifice. Take your sacrifice, cause you don't know if it's an afterlife. If it's an afterlife.
Yeah. Do this for my jewel and my gem. Those are my daughters, I do it for them. I did it before and I do it again. I sacrifice again and again. Everything I haven't owned, through them my legacy lives on. For every day a child is born, a soul is taken, passing on. Sacrifice to sacrifice, life is like cold and ice. I give my last bag of rice, cause you will not starve tonight. You will not die of hunger. All my life put me under the jail. Lose the key like George Jackson did for me. Troy Davis, I'm Troy Davis. I say it again and again. He was murdered on death row like many innocent men. When I say innocent, I mean innocent, never proved too much doubt. When they can't take your dignity, they're trying to take you out. I offer this sacrifice of blood, food, and rum, and need me to all the dead till the ceremony's done. Jonathan Jackson, Lolita LeBron, and young Lord Chacha Jimenez, they all sacrifice their lives for us to
take
be here present.
Take your sacrifice. Take your sacrifice. Cause you don't know if it's an afterlife. If it's an afterlife. Take your sacrifice. Take your sacrifice, cause you don't know if it's an afterlife. If it's an afterlife.
When the revolution comes, black cultural centers will be fought, supplying revolutionaries with food and arms when the revolution comes. Speak not of revolution until you are willing to eat rats to survive.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was Dead Prez with Sacrifice, otherwise known as Welcome Home, Comrades. And, of course, we heard from the legendary Fred Hampton himself of the Black Panther Party, a martyr in the struggle for black liberation in the United States, who was killed while he slept on his bed by more than 22 police bullets. When he could not have been considered a threat whatsoever. It was political assassination, which killed him. As is what happened to other members of the numerous other members of the Black Panther Party. One of the things I would like to say, I talked about Huey P. Newton, co-founder of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense last week. Of course, back in the USSR is focused on Black History Month over the last several weeks. Been doing shows on the heroic figures, some of the heroic figures of that, of the struggle of African-American people for self-determination, you know, in the face of a racist colonial capitalist state in North America. But what I want to focus on here tonight, what I want to start with here tonight, about a week or so ago, a political prisoner was set free in the United States. A man who served, a former Black Panther who served 43 years. 43 years in solitary confinement. A political prisoner. And a radical until the end. His name was Albert Woodfox. He's one of the group of prisoners known as the Angola Three. And the last one of them to be released. So I'm going to read... from an article that was posted in The Guardian about a week or so ago, dealing with his first interview as a free man. And it goes like this. I'm going to start with the title. Albert Woodfox speaks after 43 years in solitary confinement. Quote, "I would not let them drive me insane." In 1951, scientists at McGill University conducted an experiment in which they subjected male graduates to solitary confinement in a simulated prison cell to see how many would cope with prolonged isolation. The study was intended to run for 6 weeks but was abruptly terminated after only 7 days because several students began hallucinating and suffering from severe mental breakdowns. Albert Woodfox has been held in such conditions of extreme isolation in Louisiana prisons and jails, not just for 7 days, but for 15,000. On Friday, after 43 years and 10 months of almost continuous captivity, virtually alone in a 6-foot by 9-foot cell, America's longest standing solitary confinement prisoner finally walked free. How did he do it? How did Albert Woodfox remain sane for more than 4 decades in the bleakest and most inhumane of circumstances, which have been denounced by the United Nations as a form of torture and would have broken the will of lesser mortals in a matter of days? In his first interview since being released from West Feliciana Parish Detention Center in Louisiana, Woodfox told The Guardian that in 1972, when he was put into, quote, closed cell restriction, or CCR, he made a conscious decision that he would survive. He and his comrades from the so-called Angola Three, Herman Wallace and Robert King, made a vow to be strong. Quote, "We made a conscious decision that we would never become institutionalized," he said. Quote, "As the years went by, we made efforts to improve and motivate ourselves. The key," he said, "was to stay connected to what was happening in the outside world. You know, we made sure we always remained concerned about what was going on in society. That way we knew that we would never give up. I promised myself that I would not let them break me, not let them drive me insane." So he kept his brain engaged, avidly reading newspapers and magazines for at least 2 hours each day, and watching documentaries and current affairs programs on the small TV he was allowed in his cell. In recent months, that meant following the rise of Donald Trump, a helpful subject for Woodfox, as it easily riled him, driving out other less healthy thoughts. Donald Trump has exposed the systemic racism in America, Woodfox says. He has catered to the worst elements in people, encouraging us to be selfish and see things only through our own eyes. The newly released prisoner is aware that when it came to surviving life in a solitary cell, he was one of the lucky ones. Over 43 years, he saw many others who were not so resilient. Many solitary confinement prisoners were unable to read and write, and so had less intellectual muscle to keep them going. The results were not pretty. Quote, some of the guys found the pressure so great that they just laid down in a fetal position and stopped communicating with anybody. I've seen other guys who just want to talk and make noise, guys who want to scream. Breaking up manifests itself in any number of ways in individuals. Woodfox spent almost all of the 43 years in lockdown, much of it in Louisiana's notorious Angola prison, in a 6-foot by 9-foot cell with concrete bunks and a metal toilet and sink. The cell had iron bars at the front, which at least allowed him to hear other prisoners. His most recent lockup in West Feliciana Parish Jail, where he was awaiting a third trial for the 1972 murder of a police officer, of which he has always professed his innocence, didn't even have that facility. It had a solid steel door that enclosed Woodfox entirely as if in a tomb. The only view out of the concrete cell was a tiny slit of a window that presented a sliver of sky. For more than 4 decades, he was held in those cells alone for 23 hours a day. The remaining hour was spent in the exercise yard, a rather attractive way of describing a concrete box lined with barbed wire fencing, which he could walk around shackled and entirely on his own. Despite his vows to survive, the years took their toll. He went through bouts of claustrophobia and panic attacks. For 1 3-year period, Woodfox suffered such intense claustrophobia that every time he lay down, he felt he was being smothered. So he took to leaning his mattress against the wall, wrapping himself in a blanket and sleeping sitting up. I used to talk to myself to convince myself that I was strong enough to survive. You know, just to hold on to my sanity. The panic attack started with sweating. You sweat and you can't stop. You become soaking wet. You are asleep in your bunk and everything is soaking wet. Then when the claustrophobia starts, it feels like the atmosphere is pressing down on you. That was hard. I used to talk to myself to convince myself I was strong enough to survive, just to hold on to my sanity until the feeling went away. There were times when he came very close to the edge. Losing his great friend and fellow political prisoner Herman Wallace was very difficult. Wallace was released from a Louisiana prison in 2013, but not until he had reached the end stage of terminal liver cancer. He died 2 days after being set free, having endured 41 years in solitary confinement, just like his buddy Albert Woodfox. The nearest Woodfox came to losing his mind was when his mother died and he wasn't allowed to attend the funeral. "That was the closest I came to cracking," he said. "All my strength I inherited from my mom. I was thankful she lived long enough for me to tell her I loved her and that she was my real hero." Psychologists have known about the serious adverse effects of prolonged isolation for at least 60 years, from studies including that aborted 1951 McGill experiment. More recent research on long-time solitary prisoners has recorded the severe side effects suffered by many, including hallucinations and perception disorders, panic attacks, loss of memory, and paranoia amounting to a form of delirium that can often lead to suicide attempts. Such medical evidence led the UN to declare lockdown a potential form of torture and to demand that all countries ban it except in very exceptional circumstances. Despite the clear scientific warnings, the practice continues to be widespread across the U.S. The most authoritative recent survey found that in 2014, up to 100,000 prisoners were put in disciplinary segregation or some other form of solitary confinement. Woodfox was convicted to a life sentence for the killing of a prison officer, Brent Miller, in 1972, having already been in prison for armed robbery. He insists that he and Herman Wallace were framed for the murder because they were members of the Black Panther movement and were actively campaigning against the racial segregation that still existed in Angola prison in the 1970s. Woodfox also made himself unpopular with white prison guards by speaking out against the brutal conditions to which black prisoners were subjected when they were sent out to the sugarcane and cotton fields to work as virtual slaves. Our political activities marked us, and that's why they locked us up in solitary confinement, where I remained until yesterday, he said. His release was secured through a plea deal in which the state of Louisiana agreed to drop the threat of a third trial for the Brent Miller killing. Two previous ones were struck down by the courts on grounds of racial discrimination and ineffective legal representation, in return for Woodfox pleading no contest. Woodfox stressed that the terms of the agreement mean he holds on to his innocence. It's an evil. You know, solitary confinement is the most torturous experience a human being can be put through in prison. I am innocent. The fact that I was convicted the first or second times had more to do with racism in the American judicial system than with innocence or guilt. He says that he hopes to use his newfound freedom to seek proper medical treatment for a raft of health problems and to reacquaint himself with his family. Hopefully I can become a part of my family and remain socially active, he said. Woodfox says he wants to be a voice for those who have no voice, be a shield for those who can't protect themselves. Above all, that means using whatever strength he has left, to press for an end to solitary confinement in America. It's an evil. Solitary confinement is the most torturous experience a human being can be put through in prison. It's punishment without ending. We have to stop this. And having been a victim of it for so long, myself, that's what I'm going to do. So once again, welcome home, Comrade Woodfox. 43 years and unbroken. You know, unbroken. And this is certainly not an isolated incident. You know, of course, like, you know, he was part of three prisoners who were held in solitary confinement for more than 40 years. And, you know, there were numerous cases of black members of the Black Panther Party being held this way. Maybe not for quite so long, but, you know, being persecuted, being sent to prison on trumped up charges, being framed for things they didn't commit, having evidence planted on them. All because the capitalist state wanted to jail political radicals. And there's a few examples which Michael Parenti here, this is just a few examples, this is by no means a complete list. A few examples I want to cite from Michael Parenti's book, The Democracy for the Few, where he lists some of the political prisoners in the United States. You know, he talks about community activist and leader of African self-determination, Fred Hampton Jr., you know, the son of Black Panther Party leader Fred Hampton, who was murdered by law officers in the 1960s. Fred Hampton Jr. was tried on a bogus charge of arson in Chicago. During the trial, no evidence was produced demonstrating that Hampton was connected to the fires or that they had ever actually happened. Yet he was given 18 years and later subject to serious mistreatment in prison for organizing around inmates' rights. Prisoners who propagate radical political views or who engage in protests regarding prison conditions have been singled out from mind control programs, subjected to mind-altering drugs, beatings, forced rectal searches, prolonged shackling, isolation, and other tortures, many of which were experienced by Albert Woodfox himself. Inmates in U.S. prisons, noted Amnesty International in 1998, have reportedly been put in supermax units because of their political affiliation. Supermax is, of course, like the maximum security, you know, solitary confinement. Basically, you're trapped in like a metal box basically all day. That's supermax prisons. You know, and, you know, absolutely they are a form of torture. From 1968 to 1971, over 300 members of the Black Panther Party were arrested. Many held without bail or trial for long durations. at least 10 former Panthers convicted on fabricated evidence and testimony that was subsequently recanted served 30 years each in prison. And still in prison as of 2000 were three Panthers, Herman Bell, Anthony Bottom, and Albert Washington, whose trial included perjured testimony and evidence suppressed by the prosecution. Panther leader Geronimo Pratt was charged with murdering a woman when he was a UCLA student. The FBI conveniently lost the security records showing that, conveniently lost its surveillance records showing that Pratt was actually 400 miles away attending a Panther meeting in Oakland at the time of the murder. The FBI chose to let the real murderer go free in order to jail a political radical. Pratt finally had his conviction overturned in 1997 and was paid a settlement of $4.5 million. There was the highly celebrated death row case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, ex-Panther, radio journalist, and articulate critic of social injustice and police brutality, who had been under police and FBI surveillance for years, even though he had no criminal record. He was shot while trying to stop a cop from beating his brother. The officer who did the beating was killed by one of the bullets fired. In a deeply flawed trial involving an incompetent defense, police perjury, and intimidated witnesses, Abu-Jamal was convicted of murder, even though no ballistic evidence linked him to the shooting, and several eyewitnesses claimed that another man shot the cop and fled the scene. But once again, they chose to let the murderer go free in order to jail a political radical. You know, and that's only a few examples. I mean, I could give you many, many, many more examples. In fact, Michael Parenti cites many, many more in this book, in his book, Democracy for the Few. You know, political prisoners in the United States. You know how, you know, the U.S. State Department usually, like, makes such a huge amount of noise every year about political prisoners in other countries and pretends that there are no political prisoners in the United States. But of course, there's political prisoners who have been there, you know, for decades, and they're still in confinement now, such as Albert Woodfox was. You know, 43 years of solitary confinement. Once again, framed for a crime he didn't do. No evidence was ever produced linking him to anything. But he was a member of the Black Panthers, and that was enough for the state to crack down on him and put him in jail. Put him in basically a 6 foot, 9 foot box for 43 years. Now, how horrific is that? But of course, once again, not an isolated incident. You know, we're dealing with a prison industrial complex in the United States. The prison system is integral to the capitalist system, maintaining capitalist control, maintaining the class order. There essentially is a school to prison pipeline in low-income, particularly the African-American communities in the United States, where, you know, like, basically black youth are almost prepared for prison, you know, from the time they're really very small children, you know, through the circumstances of their lives, the way they're taught, you know, the way schools are organized, the way, they, like, you know, community is organized, the way all, you know, the way their lives are oppressed from day one. You know, and that's a horrific thing. That's an inhuman thing. That is structural racism. It's the face of structural racism in America. You know, and the horrific things it does to people. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR. I'm going to play a poem about that from a teacher's perspective. Someone who's in these schools and who sees the kind of people, you know, these kids who are going through this education system that's practically preparing them for prison. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
I'm just going to jump right in. I work in a school, but I have never been required to teach a full lesson of academic value. Worksheets, standardized test score, high school dropout of the pedagogy of poverty. Critical thinking is too dangerous a skill to give to the curious when the answers all demand a revolution of question marks. Still, I try to teach empathy to children who believe respect comes only after violence and that civilization is a white man's prison. I mean, what civility have they seen in the coffins cleverly disguised as Section 8 housing, tombstones of hope with epitaphs written in gang signs and urine? Where was this so-called civilization when 50 shots rang like bells in Jamaica, Queens? Or when Skittles shattered the concrete in Florida? Or when the nightsticks pierced the dark LA side highway? The message consistent. Yes, you can still be lynched for being black. Only they don't use rope and throw parties anymore. Bullets and television provide the necessary distance from the reality of murder. Politicians no longer proliferate racism from behind their white hoods because they don't need to. Lil Wayne and the media have teamed up to do it for them. Racial slurs sung across my classroom like burning crosses. And when I question the use of a word that has been better off dead, I am reminded that I am white and should not comment on things I do not understand. Besides, miss, the word means friend if you drop the last R. This is the civilization that Reaganomics has trickled down in the form of food stamps. The 99% is sick because welfare cannot buy organic. Processed hormones grow the labor force quick because life expectancy is short at the bottom, which is neither well nor fair. The children in my classroom are already having difficulty seeing through the dollar sign sewn in to their eyelashes. Wealth is the cruelest carrot of gentrification. Growing neighborhoods treating my kids like weeds to be choked out, hanging on the branches of Jim Crow attitudes and increased rent. School buildings being treated like pipelines to jail cells for minds that are brilliant, who understand that if getting an education is about getting a job to make money, then a DOE diploma is not the quickest way to get there. The untaxed cash that comes from selling addiction is much more profitable than the student loans that a higher education offers. The 10% unemployment rate does not breed hope in the young minds till the classroom is their way out. A way out of what, they ask me? The projects and into debt? It is at this point, as a teacher, I begin to wonder when I was made to be a slave trader for capitalism. Thank you.
Back in the USSR, we'll be back after this short break.
Hi, I'm James Gordon, and you are fortunate enough to be listening to CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph.
This is James Valvano, founder and president of WeHaveAFace.org, Inc. We advocate internationally for Huntington's disease and juvenile Huntington's disease, a genetic, hereditary, and terminal degenerative brain disease. It affects women, men, and children across the globe. It is like having Parkinson's, ALS, Alzheimer's, and schizophrenia, all at the same time. On April 23rd, WeHaveAFace.org will be showing our international film, The Huntington's Disease Project, Removing the Mask. It will take place at the University of Guelph in Alexander Hall. Doors will be open at 12:30 p.m. and the viewing of the documentary starts at 2:30 p.m. In cooperation with the Huntington Society of Canada, WeHaveAFace.org looks forward to this educational and free event. Please visit WeHaveAFace.org/Canada.
Alexander Hall is a physically accessible location.
Are you drawn to aggressive sounds? Are you subject to violent outbursts of rage? Do you have sudden urges to destroy everything in sight? If so, we have just the thing for you.
Forever Death!
Forever Death on 93.3 CFRU, Thursday nights at 10 after 10 following the BBC.
The Legal Clinic of Guelph and Wellington County is available to students who have concerns about their rental unit. Some of the concerns we can advise you on include whether your unit is protected under the Residential Tenancies Act, if the terms in your lease are legal, maintenance concerns, problems with your landlord, including the landlord interfering with your use and enjoyment of the unit, how to end a tenancy, and how to assign or sublet a unit. The Legal Clinic will be at the Student Help and Advocacy Center, located in the University Center across from the CSA office. The Legal Clinic will be in during the winter 2016 semester on Wednesdays between 1 to 4 p.m. until April 16th. Students can make an appointment at the SHAC office or can drop in. Otherwise, the Legal Clinic can be reached at 519 519- 821-2100, through our website at www.gwlegalclinic.ca, or by coming down to the office, which is located within the Guelph Community Health Center at 176 Wyndham Street North. Both our locations are physically accessible.
Okay, you're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, and I realize there has been a serious deficit in my, you could say, my discussion of Black History Month. And, you know, many of you probably will have realized by now this deficit in my reporting, in my commentary. I have not done an adequate job at all addressing the struggles of African-American women, or notable African-American women, you know, who have participated in, played a massive role, played a major role in the struggle for African-American liberation. And this is largely because my knowledge with regard to that is not nearly as complete as it should be. And also, it's not something I feel confident in, a story I feel confident in telling, because of that lack of knowledge. And this is something I must work on, I myself, you know, recognizing this deficit. But needless to say, particularly with regard to the Black Panther Party, women played a massive role in building that party, in spreading that party, you know, keeping it moving forward, developing its policies, you know, developing its strategies, its approach. You know, and really making it all happen. By 1970, you know, almost basically two-thirds of the Black Panther Party was women. It was a truly remarkable ratio. And one of the things which was truly remarkable that Colin Jenkins notes in a recent article which he did for the Fred Hampton Institute, you know, entitled "An Ideal Blueprint: The Original Black Panther Party Model and Why It Should Be Duplicated in the present struggle," you know, surrounding Black Lives Matter and what have you. One of the things he pointed out was how intersectional the Black Panther Party was, and I'm just going to quote him here. He says, "Due to their solid theoretical framework, the party was able to deploy a proto-intersectionality that allowed them to go beyond issues of racial oppression and police brutality in order to address broad roots and common causes. In doing so, they were able to redirect the emotional rage brought on by targeted racism and channel it into a far-reaching indictment of the system. This created the potential for broad coalitions and opened up avenues for unity and solidarity with revolutionary counterparts, especially with regard to Black women. Despite stifling elements of misogyny and sexism, the emergence of women as key figures in the Black Power movement was ironically made possible through the Black Panther Party. One of the party's early leaders, Elaine Brown, pointed to a conscious effort on the part of female members to overcome patriarchy from within party lines. And she says how, you know, at first, a woman in the Black Power movement was considered at best irrelevant, explains Brown. A woman asserting herself was a pariah. It was a violation of some Black Power principle that was left undefined. If a black woman assumed a role of leadership, she was said to be eroding Black manhood. Leaders like Brown, despite carrying this heavy burden of being drawn into a fight within the fight, were incredibly important to the party's mission and became highly influential members, local leaders, fierce orators, and public representatives for the party at large. Brown made impressive runs for Oakland City Council in 1973 and 1975, receiving 30% and 44% of the vote respectively. In 1977, she managed Lionel Wilson's Oakland mayoral campaign, which resulted in Wilson becoming the city's first Black mayor. Regarding the dynamics of sexuality and gender in the party, journalist and activist Annie Brown tells us, "The Black Panther Party had an open mind towards sexual expression, as well as the roles women could play in social change organizations. The embrace of female empowerment and varied sexual identities within the party allowed for women like Angela Davis to rise to prominent positions of power within the party, while other radical organizations of the time, such as Students for a Democratic Society and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, saved leadership roles for men and forced women to remain in the background. After addressing these early pockets of misogyny and hypermasculinity, the party was shaped heavily by women, to the point where it transformed gender roles in the Black Power movement and paved the way for similar developments in other grassroots movements in the U.S. In researching for her forthcoming book, What You've Got Is Revolution, Black Women's Movements for Black Power, historian Ashley Farmer found the party's newspaper regularly defied gender roles by depicting women as strong, gun-toting revolutionaries, while female party members were heavily involved in setting a community-focused revolutionary agenda that supported programs for daycare, groceries, and housing. In addition to celebrating women as tough revolutionaries, the newspaper included an explicit focus on women's issues throughout its publication. For years, Women Panthers assumed leadership roles and turned toward local-level activism, providing food, housing, and healthcare in local Black communities. The inclusion of women as active participants in the struggle was eventually, if not initially, embraced by its founding members. As historian Robin Spencer writes, Seal and Newton didn't exclude African-American women in their rhetoric or in their involvement. The message became, Black brothers and sisters unite for real social action. This development within the party's evolution led to a membership that was majority, roughly two-thirds female by the early 1970s, a desirable goal for a modern left that still possesses a troublesome andocratic identity. Now, without further ado, I want to play right now a speech that was given at the UCLA in 1971 by one of the most prominent women in the Black Panther Party, Kathleen Cleaver. Now, she gave this speech at a time when many of the Black Panther Party leadership was in jail, and she was kind of coordinating the struggle and was a big part of the struggle for raising money, organizing their defense, their legal defense, and ensuring that they came home. The state did not lock these guys in jail, these men and women in jail, for decades and decades and decades, which of course is what they wanted to do, when they were putting trumped up charges on these people. She was helping to organize the legal defense, and she talks a lot about that and talks a lot about fighting for the liberation of political prisoners in particular in this speech, which she gives at the UCLA in 1971. So I'm going to play that right now. It's pretty intense stuff. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Good afternoon. My name is Gabe Elias, and as chairman of the Speakers Program, I would like to welcome you to our third program of the fall quarter. Today we have with us Kathleen Cleaver, who has just recently returned from Algeria. Her topic for today will be Black Revolution in the United States, and will be followed by a question and answer period. At this point, I would like to introduce Paul Williams, chairman of the BSU at UCLA, for a few short remarks, followed by Mrs. Cleaver's address.
Thank you. The Black Student Union feels in this situation that we have the opportunity to give you the pleasure of meeting a beautiful Black woman. The Black Student Union in the past have made it a point to give a cross-section of political thought for Black students on this campus to have a clear understanding of what our struggle means. I'm not going to go into no long speech. I'm just going to make it clear that this is the point of the Black Student Union here on this campus. Under the auspices of ASUCLA Speakers Program, and with the support of the Black Student Union, I introduce Kathleen Cleaver.
All power to the people, brothers and sisters. Right on. You have to excuse us from being late. We were sort of blocked by LAPD white cars. I don't know, CCS, CCI, whichever one. And we got tied up trying to get down to the court for Geronimo's trial. And furthermore, we received information that the FBI, they didn't say who, but, you know, these pigs, they might anticipate an incident, and if anything is provoked, they wanted to be able to call this special act so they could bring the LAPD down here in force. So, you know, how they do these things, if everybody be cool, and then we know who the pigs are, because we know they're in here, see. They're running this. In terms of the political situation, it's very clearly delineated in California, especially in terms of the concrete development of the fascist state, which is at its most advanced stage in California, and really very highly concentrated in an urban fashion in Los Angeles. In terms of the key issue, the central issue in the liberation struggle at this particular time, I'm sure you're all aware of it, it is the issue of the political prisoner. The vanguard force in the liberation struggle at this present time is the imprisoned population, and there are specific prison populations that are very key. We have the political prisoners, those of the revolutionary forces, the political activists, and those who are being imprisoned to prevent them from carrying out their political activities. A very classic example of this is the case of the LA 13, and in particular, Brother Geronimo, formerly Deputy Defense Minister of the Southern California chapter of the Black Panther Party, who are presently on trial now. I think all of you could recall the LA shootout in December and that event and what that is about, and that trial is presently going on really in obscurity. There is the issue of the military prisoner, and I don't mean just the soldier in the army who is a prisoner of the military machine, but the military prisoner, the political within the stockade of the military. And in the state of California, in the stockade of Fort Ord, held in maximum security at the present time, is a black brother from Watts, who's returned from Vietnam and being held on charges of fragging, killing some white officers, and the military is calling for the death penalty. Now, the thing that makes this case very classic is the fact that never in the history of the United States have they ever called for the death penalty of a soldier in the U.S. Army. And they choose this black soldier to call the death penalty upon Brother Billy Dean Smith. At the same time, they let Lieutenant Calley parade around as some type of national hero. We see he's a hero to the fascists. And the fascists are supporting him, and this is why he can carry on like this. Then we come to the key imprisoned population, the real base of this liberation struggle, and where you find the most profoundly dedicated forces in the liberation struggle in California in particular, and that is the convict population, the black convict population in these prisons. An example that brings that to your mind is the assassination of Brother George Jackson. But the trial of the other two, the Soledad brothers, is going on now in San Francisco. And you have to understand there is a definite interrelationship between the struggle of the revolutionaries, the forces within the prisons and without the prisons, within the military and without the military, within the political organizations and without the political organizations. And it all links up in the relationship of the underground. Because you see, there's a cycle in this revolutionary momentum, in this phase of development of the struggle at the present time. Whether you come from the prison or from the military or whether you come from the streets, you get the choice of going either to the military or to jail. Whether you come from the above ground and are forced underground or to jail. You see the same people moving around in this cycle of revolutionary action, especially in California. It's very clear in California. We're very concerned about issues here because it's sure that, you know, it was in California that the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense was originated, and that the Black Panther Party got its birth and proceeded to develop the Afro-American liberation struggle. And it must be very clearly understood by everybody, because apparently a great confusion has been caused by some so-called Panthers and some so-called revolutionaries during the past 2 years that the Black Panther Party had something to do with creating the Afro-American liberation struggle, when in fact it's the other way around. The Afro-American liberation struggle produced the Black Panther Party as a vehicle of its advancement, and as long as that instrument is advancing the struggle, then it's revolutionary and vanguard. And the minute it stops doing that, it's blocking, it's retarding. It is not a vanguard. It is not a relevant organization at the present time. The present structure, the present operation being carried out by these masqueraders, these phonies, these fakes, and they're very well known to the real Panthers, who are also well known to the real police, and who are also still being persecuted, tortured, arrested, killed, and shot throughout this country without your knowledge, because of the complicity of the so-called Panther Party with these forces of oppression to make a compromise so that they get the heat off of them, you see? So this is why we say that the Black Panther Party is any type of revolutionary force is dead. The Black Panthers, however, are alive. The Black Panthers are in jails. The Black Panthers are running. The Black Panthers are starving. And we cannot sit here passively and look at these egomaniacs, or whatever they want to call themselves, go around and parade as if the Black Panther Party belongs to them. Because we know across this country there are hundreds, 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 thousands, thousands, thousands of black people, poor people, white people, all kinds of people that dedicated something to building the Black Panther Party. The base of that party was Afro-American black lumpen proletariat in the cities, in the ghettos throughout this country, in California, in the Midwest, in the East Coast, and now in the South. This is the Black Panther Party, not this apparatus that parades around and passes out this disgusting newspaper, and it's nothing, it's just a haven for a police informants at this point. It's absurd. And this is why it has become necessary for us to, in the international section, to move in this manner to clear up all these contradictions and confusions about the Black Panther Party that you are being subjected to and are using as an excuse not to do anything and not to relate. Because the case of Geronimo in Los Angeles, the case of Landon and Roy in New Haven, the case of the brothers in jail in New Orleans, all these brothers, these revolutionaries, have been abandoned and are let at the mercy of the power structure. And these are the people that move the party, move the struggle, and these are the revolutionary forces that the pigs want. They don't care about that other stuff. We feel, from the information that we've received, that the present status of Huey P. Newton, I'm sure many of you are aware of this, or maybe many of you are not, is that of a Manchurian candidate, that the man was a revolutionary who was arrested and taken into the California Department of Corrections penal system. He was released in a surprise move at a particular time that was somewhat crucial. And when he was released, he was no longer the same person. And during this period of time, he had been subjected and programmed to many types of various drug treatments and distortions and psychotherapeutic arrangements in the these brain-twisting, people-killing centers that they are run by the Department of Corrections of the State of California in Atascadero, in Vacaville, and CMC East. Now, those names might not mean anything to you, but you remember them because you might find yourself in those same institutions. And don't you believe it's not possible. This so-called split that many people have made much to do about is not a split. It is development and is a transition so that the revolutionary forces that were organized at one time through the party, many of whom after a certain period in time went on to organize other organizations and participate in another level because they could not participate in revolutionary activity with this apparatus. This so-called split has been the coming to head of internal contradictions within the party since its foundation, but as the party grew and developed resolving of contradictions that finally came out in an open break. And these contradictions that existed as a legitimate phase of the development of the liberation forces and the development of ideology through practice and theory and practice and theory were also picked up on by the police forces, in particular the LAPD criminal conspiracy section and the FBI working out of L.A., and manipulated upon and played upon through whisper campaigns, and he said this and he did that, and false information, and all of these little tricky tactics that they use to confuse people and distort them and make them paranoid and withdraw and all these types of things. So you have to look at the situation and look what has been done to the Black Panther Party primarily through three forces. You have the outright blatant police attacks. Then you have the police infiltration, and this infiltration is on many levels. Don't you think it's not? From Washington, D.C., or the Pentagon, the FBI, the CCI, the IDA, all of them. I don't even know their names, and it's not relevant because it's all different levels and different aspects of pigs, of enemies, all right, that have brought about this split throughout the country. And there are many splits in the party that have carried on without your knowledge, and nobody jumped up and said anything about it until the international section made public the fact that they no longer went along with it. And this was the point at which the whole party had already left, and there wasn't really too much left but some young, innocent lackeys, terrorized, intimidated people, and some police informants, and so-called Central Committee. But what has happened to the party and the final outcome of this has created a tremendous setback and a disappointment to the community of Black people, to the community of revolutionaries, to the people that look to that for some type of leadership and direction, and to the international revolutionary movement, because whether or not you know it, the Black Panther Party was recognized as a vanguard force not only in this country but throughout the world, especially in Africa. And the destruction of the Black Panther Party by these combined forces of agents, of pigs, of jailings, of prisons, of brutalities, of murders. I'm sure you're fully aware of many of these murders, one in particular, but this has really destroyed the Black Panther Party, and they have been cooperated, this process has been collaborated upon by the counter-revolutionary and revisionists, and this is what it is. Leadership offered by the David Hilliard, June Hilliard clique. And we say this because this is exactly what it is. We are not calling names. And if we want to get into a question and answer session, we can go into details about this. We know you don't know these things. It was none of your business. You see, we hoped to be resolved these things internally, but it became impossible. But everybody needs to understand this stuff so they don't be lost in a maze of confusion, and they don't allow this and these contradictions and the way they affected things in Los Angeles are very, very pertinent to the fact that this brother Geronimo and these brothers who defended the central office during the shootout are up in the county jail and sitting in that courtroom, and nobody's outside there relating to it, you see, and this is exactly what they want. They think they got a clear-cut railroad, and this is their final coup of destroying the Black Panther Party, and the Black Panther Party is a name that's irrelevant, you see? That's why we say that's dead, forget about that, later for it. Destroying these revolutionary forces that were organized, coordinated, and moving in the L.A. area against these police forces, and they know it, and they don't tell you, because what's been going on across this country is a direct confrontation between the revolutionaries in the Panther Party, the military and political revolutionaries in the party, and the police departments. Whether you know it or not, that line of demarcation had been drawn, and that war had been initiated. Specifically, in relation to UCLA, I cannot come into this campus without a very profound sorrow.
Listen to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. This is listen to a speech by Kathleen Cleaver of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, speaking at UCLA in 1971. So please stay tuned.
Because one of the original forces of this revolutionary action in the state of California, person who came out of the prisons of California, was active in the struggle, the liberation struggle going on within the prisons, continued to be active in the liberation struggle within the streets, continued to be active in using the Black Panther Party as a vehicle to advance this struggle, was murdered in cold blood on this very campus. And I'm talking about someone that you all have heard of, Bunchy! Our apprentice Bunchy Carter. And that name might not mean nothing in this audience, but that means something outside, all right? And you better believe it. That was a black convict coming out here to deal with this. And the brother that was with him, Brother John Huggins, that was a black GI that had came out the military to deal with this. And when those two beautiful brothers were eliminated by who? Who were they eliminated by, brothers and sisters? Who? Name them. No, the two brothers that he sent. Name them. Right on, Brother Steiner. Right here on this campus with guns, the blood was shed. And they went down here. That was a vicious attack on our forces of liberation, engineered by the LAPD and carried out by their black lackeys, the Steiner brothers, members of the US organization. And don't you think that organization isn't engaging in the same type of activities? After that murder, the leadership or the direction of the party fell on the shoulders of Brother Geronimo. Brother Geronimo came out of the U.S. military, out of the special forces, out of the Green Berets in Vietnam with Purple Hearts and medals. Out of that battlefield into this. And everything that he learned and everything that he suffered, he brought those skills back to the struggling people in this country, back to his brothers and sisters in the streets, back to the victims of fascism, LA style, and attempted to deal with it. And there's been a consistent attempt to move against him and eliminate him throughout the LA police forces, many cases. The US organization was instrumental in that. The LA raid was a part of that. But they finally caught up with G through a little cotton picking informant named Cotton. Melvin Smith. And you have to be aware of these things. Maybe you don't realize that, but this is what they're doing in this community around you. Paying and buying little petty-minded lackeys to go out and destroy forces that are fighting for your liberation. Going out and selling blood money, giving blood money to these who will allow fascism to get that much colder and leave you to deal with it. Now, can you deal with it? Or can you deal with helping somebody that is equipped to deal with it and trained to deal with it and willing to deal with it survive? And that's a decision that you have to make. And this contradiction in the Black Panther Party, the split in the Black Panther Party, it exploded over the arrest of Geronimo because the man was betrayed. He was set up. And he was arrested in Dallas, Texas, through the collaboration of the Hilliard and Newton and Elaine Brown and Masai Hewitt clique. Financed by tax money, you know, FBI, CIA, this and that. Don't think I'm just throwing this out, you see? He was arrested, held in Texas for 3 months. And there was no word on this. And if any of you read this rag sheet, I don't know how many people here read that shit. They purged the man as soon as he was extradited to California and told all kind of lies about him, etc. And behind this purge, they blocked any type of apparatus of support for this case, not only of Geronimo, but of the LA 13. Meanwhile, in between this arrest and the LA shootout, all the little lackeys had done everything they possibly could to dissipate the support of the people. And this is how they operate. They operate this everywhere. And this is why this whole so-called movement is in this present state, because they've terrorized, arrested, convicted, and done all these things to demoralize and have people isolated and confused. And this is just a tactic. It's a tactic called for by the Nixon administration, just as the assassination of Bunchy Carter and John Huggins.